Welcome to Nonprofit Expert, presented by Donor Perfect.
Thank you for joining us. It's my pleasure to welcome you to Nonprofit Expert, presented by Donor Perfect. And in this series of conversations, we're talking about respect and relationships and resources, and how successful development programs are mindful of all three and make sure that they are properly structured and resourced for success. I'm so excited right now to introduce you to Birgit Smith-Burton. Birgit and I met each other through AFP, and we share having served, she currently and me in the past, having served as a board chair of AFP Global. Her body of work is much more broad and extensive than that. And I'm going to ask her to share with you a little bit more about her professional journey and the role she's had and the things she's working on now. So first of all, Birgit, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I'm so glad to be able to share this space with you. You don't know that when I used to see you when you were the global board chair and you would be up on the stage at the podium, I thought, what job is that? That is so huge and important. And I could never be that. And you set the bar so high that, you know, I thought, it's not possible. But you have been so kind in how you've supported me and been just a role model. So I just want to thank you for that. My journey as a fundraiser, you know, like many of my contemporaries, you know, I stumbled into a career. But what I'm most proud of, it's my first 11 years where I worked for the United Negro College Fund. They were hiring novice fundraisers or those that had no experience, as long as you had a college degree. And UNCF, you know, helped us learn fundraising. And that's where I cut my fundraising teeth, per se. And then I was hired by Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta. And, you know, I was hired as the associate director for foundation relations, which was something I couldn't even imagine that there was a job for a person who was the second in charge when it came to managing the university's foundation relationships. But I was kind of glad that they didn't hire me as they originally intended to serve as the first director of development for Georgia Tech and Emory's joint biomedical engineering school, because that was really kind of scary to think that I would be raising money for biomedical engineering. So I just retired from Georgia Tech after 25 years. Oh, and let me also say that while at Georgia Tech, in 1998, when they hired me, I was the first frontline fundraiser of color that Georgia Tech had ever hired. And so kind of going back to my fundraising roots of, you know, starting my career working for the United Negro College Fund, I did decide to create the African American Development Officers Network, AADO, which connected me with the fundraisers in what's called the Atlanta University Center, which are the historically Black colleges and universities in Atlanta, not far from Georgia Tech. So,
and that's certainly grown so much. That's grown so much. Talk a little bit more about that.
Oh yeah, from 25. So I reached out to my counterparts at Morris Brown, Clark Atlanta University, Spelman, Morehouse. And, you know, invited them to join me in creating this network. So there were about 25, 50 of us, and we would meet annually at Georgia Tech. And now, 25 years later, the network is nearly 4,000 members strong across the country and in Canada. And 85% are fundraisers of color, or those in the fundraising profession. And the remainder are allies and talent managers.
Your work's not done, that's for sure.
Not at all.
And what you've been talking about, of course, is relationships. because none of that would have been possible without relationships. And you wouldn't have stayed at the fund that long. You wouldn't have been involved at Georgia Tech that long had you not been really, really good at relationships. And I know when we were talking earlier, you mentioned four key elements that are necessary for healthy relationships: trust, credibility, accountability, and transparency. And of course, I'm sure there are others, but talk for a little bit about trust, accountability, credibility, transparency. Why are they so important? How do they play out in individual relationships?
Sure. My title, associate director for foundation relations, then I became the director of foundation relations, the senior director of foundation relations, the executive director of foundation relations. But core to my work with private philanthropic foundations, and many of them were family foundations. So we're dealing directly with the family, which was the source of the primary source of the money, was trust and credibility. And strong relationships cultivate trust. And we all know that donors are more likely to give when they believe in your organization's mission and see that you're accountable and transparent. One of the things that I didn't say that I feel is interesting, particularly, Robbie, with smaller organizations, is that your own and individual fundraiser's own financial support of an organization is viewed by a donor or a prospective donor as being really key to their belief that you believe in the mission and the vision of the organization. And I didn't note that earlier, but when I worked for UNCF, our president of the organization would not invite individuals to serve on UNCF's board solely because they were representing, a major corporate gift. They had to bring their own money, make their own gift to the organization as well. So, your company gave $100,000 to serve on that board, you also had to make a gift, your $1,000 or $5,000 gift. And it shows, a strong level of commitment. But trust and credibility is important. And I'll give you an example that I can actually share. It was public. It was in the news about a gift that was made to Georgia Tech. It was made by a Georgia Tech alum. His name was Tom Dupree Jr. And he made a $20 million pledge to Georgia Tech's College of Management. And at the time, the company's company that he was the chairman of was doing well. And the stocks were around $28 a share. By the time it came time for him to make good on that pledge, the stocks had, decreased to somewhere around, I think it was like maybe a few dollars a share, or maybe even, 28 cents a share. I know it had dropped significantly. He couldn't make good on that pledge. And it hit the news, and it was a big deal in the news. And the reason I mention that is because that did cause some, depending on how you read that news report, it did cause some trust issues with prospective donors or those who were already donors in, being able to trust the university in that, had we carefully vetted that gift and we had announced it, made it so public that we put his name on the school's College of Management, and then had to take it off. So, that's just an example of how, publicly trust issues can impact, donors' interest in giving.
You raise a very interesting point. And of course, that was a financial reversal that I'm sure he didn't have any way of predicting, nor would he have wanted to predict, but regardless, he couldn't fulfill that. I think the other thing that has caused some real trust issues with donors is the recent issues around social justice. And I don't know about your experience, but in my experience right now, boards are more and more willing to have critical conversations about what is our naming structure? What's our naming policy? Who's going to decide whether a naming can be awarded? Are there any circumstances where we would strip a naming from a building? And if so, who has to decide that? Do we unilaterally have the right to do that? And I think it's a sad commentary, but an important one for us to really understand that when we accept a commitment from someone, we're connecting their brand to our brand. We're connecting their reputation to our reputation. And the analogy I always love is imagine this beautiful flat piece of paper and you crumple it up into a ball. You can straighten it out again. You can flatten it out again, but it's never going to look the same. So repairing your reputation, do you ever get it back to where you want it to be? And I hope in the case that you're describing, people could understand he didn't intend to have this financial crisis in his life. But I think that that issue of credibility and respect is so interconnected, and boards are more willing to have those conversations, and staff who in the past may have heard, well, if we have a crisis, we'll deal with it then, are in a position to say, let's get out ahead of this. So if we have a speed bump, it doesn't become a crisis.
Well, it absolutely get out ahead of it, because you never, you're not able to anticipate, what might happen to someone financially. Or, there was a building named for Bill Cosby's wife on the Spelman campus, and it had, the Cosby name on it. And, it was a women's center. So I recall when, the situation, revolving around Bill Cosby and, his legal issues and public trial, what Spelman faced with what they should do with that name being on that building. But I will say in closure on that, it wasn't Mr. Dupree's, fault. They did accept, his explanation and named a scholarship in his honor with the money that he had already pledged and paid up to that point. So there was resolution.
And that's good, because I think I can only imagine you want to keep a strong relationship with a donor even when they have a reversal.
Sure.
And I think we saw a lot of that in the mid to 2008, 2009, where people had very difficult time. And the charities that were the strongest at the end of that were the ones that maintained the relationships with the donors, whether they could give at that time or not. So relationships are not about the cash.
No.
Relationships are about the engagement with the mission.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any other thoughts about that?
Sure. So I think about, advocacy and ambassadorship, and a couple of the organizations that I've been involved with. One was named for civil rights icon, Reverend Hosea Williams in Atlanta, Georgia. His organization started out as Hosea Feed the Hungry and Homeless. It's now Hosea Helps. He established the organization because he had come out of a restaurant with a fish sandwich wrapped in wax paper. And a man who, was without a home to live in, asked if he could have the sandwich. And Reverend Williams gave him the sandwich, and the man ate the sandwich and the wax paper all at the same time. And that impacted Reverend Williams so much, he started the organization, Hosea Feed the Hungry and Homeless. And I got involved with the organization, maybe about a decade or so after he started it, because his daughter and his son-in-law had taken it over. And so I served the organization for 17 years on the organization's board. But what I really learned by engaging with people in the community, some really big financial contributors to the organization, but also some modest givers, you know, the 100, the 200 dollar donors who, when they would spend time with the organization, serving people during the meals of Thanksgiving and Christmas and during the Martin Luther King holiday, and they would meet the people who were many times, Robbie, no different than them, and they realized that they could be a paycheck away from being in that same circumstance. Just being able to engage and be involved with the services that the organization, you know, is responsible for providing, they turned from just donors and volunteers to advocates. So they would be down at City Hall, you know, lobbying, you know, for, you know, more resources and, you know, legislation that would impact those who find themselves, you know, facing food insecurity or are unhoused. And so I really learned that beyond the gift, as you said, you know, just the transaction of making the donation. I was going to say write a check, but does anybody write a check anymore? I don't know if we do that. But beyond that, you know, they were becoming true advocates and ambassadors for the organization. I was involved with an organization that they actually created a board name instead of board members. We were called the organization's ambassadors. And one other organization was the Center for Black Women's Wellness. You know, learning how to get people to reach into their own circles of influence and find out that they had connections with people that could actually, you know, serve as in an advocate role that would really help to advance the mission of the organization. So those relationships are huge and very key to helping these organizations oftentimes advance.
You raise an interesting point about working collaboratively, and you might agree, there are always the hierarchies on paper, and then there's the way people actually engage with each other. And sometimes that fluid engagement is fine. Sometimes it can get sticky. So when you had a situation like Hosea Helps, where people took on new roles and responsibilities, did that evolve to have someone trying to coordinate those people doing lobbying at the state house or beyond? How did that work in a, and I'm imagining it was a pretty scrappy organization without a lot of extra people to take on those roles. How did that evolve?
So, you know, good point because truly I can tell you now the staff is still very small. I'm gonna guess maybe about 25 people, but the volunteers, I've seen the volunteer list is 5 and 6 and 7,000 strong, right? They come out and help. And so when they're organizing everything from, you know, helping to distribute clothing and provide medical assessments, you know, there are volunteer coordinators among the volunteers who have the expertise and the knowledge who willingly step up and help to coordinate, you know, with the volunteer coordinator from the staff, but they've got the expertise that and the connections that, you know, I recall one time going down to you know, to the city hall, you know, during you know, one of the what is it, the council meetings, to actually sign up to speak during the meeting to, you know, advocate for you know, certain grants to be given to the organization, as well as to be aware of money that needed to go out into the community through other organizations. So, you know, rallying volunteers to come together. I mean, we know, have both of us served as volunteers, that oftentimes an organization without the volunteers and without the volunteer leadership and the volunteers that step up to coordinate, the organization would never be able to do that, on their own. They don't have the bandwidth or staff to be able to organize that.
Have you in your own practice encountered a place where that fluid engagement between people at different levels or roles became a challenge
Sure.
that you had to
Yeah.
navigate? Because I think most of us in this kind of work, occasionally somebody wants to talk to us about something and it may not be the most appropriate point of entry. How do you navigate those things in your practice?
Robbie, I mean, this can be challenging and it can be touchy because I actually developed a re really, really strong relationship with a major donor's wife who actually, it was his ex-wife, who actually was extremely philanthropic. As a matter of fact, for 20 years, she gave anonymously through a fund that I was only one of a few people that knew she was the money behind it. But in establishing this relationship, it became just a little bit problematic because she valued the relationship with me, and she would actually call me on my cell phone. And sometimes she would share information that might be, well, not might be, but that for staff that were managing the foundation, might see it as a little bit kind of circumventing them. Do you know what I mean? And so,
So she had staff working, helping her distribute her fund,
yes.
and they would see that as somehow going behind their back.
Well, it just it not going behind their back. I mean, they appreciated and acknowledged and understood that it was her money. She could do whatever she wanted to do, but there still was an appropriate process. And so, I was governed by the appropriate process in terms of completing the application, submitting the proposal, all of the steps that were required to, solicit the funds. At the same time, I had developed a really good relationship with her, and she would call and sometimes share some information that might have, it wasn't that she was breaching any confidence. She was sharing her own thoughts and opinions. And that kind of informed me sometimes to make some decisions that might have been contrary to what the process was or what the foundation staff might think. So I'll give you a very simple, small answer. They might, the foundation staff might say that the limit that you can ask for is $100,000. I'm just throwing out a number for the sake of conversation. They might say the maximum you can ask for is $100,000. And she might tell me, I really like this particular program and what's happening. Yes, you should ask for a quarter million. Ask for 250,000. Do you know what I'm saying? And so that would be hard because the staff is saying no, the cutoff is 100, but the person who's holds the purse strings, whose money it is saying 250,000. So how do I do that? I don't want to upset staff because I, ha have a good relationship, but I also don't want to miss out on 150,000 more dollars. So, you know what I mean? It would be a careful, sort of avoiding landmines in, kind of sharing information, but not, disrespecting the process and giving the impression that I'm circumventing the process.
Right. Yeah, I think anytime there's a private foundation with a living donor, rules can be suggestions, and it's hard when you're the staff person. It can be very hard.
Yes.
You also shared a scenario with me where you did some consulting work at Clemson, where an interesting group of people wound up helping a donor see their potential. Do you want to share that one?
I was asked by a good friend to come in and give some advice and counsel to a small development team that was mostly consisted of fundraisers who were not diverse. There was one African-American fundraiser on the team, and they were challenged with, working with their particularly African-American alumni. And so I said, what would be great is if I organized a panel discussion and brought four Black alumni to sit in front of the development team, and they could ask any question they wanted to ask, respectfully. And so they did. And these four alums, one, he had graduated from the university in the late 60s, the first African American to earn a PhD. And he was no holds barred. He was telling it like it is. He said, don't call me, don't come see me if you aren't African-American, because I don't feel that you care what my interests are, what I want to, to fund at the university. And right now I'm not feeling the warm fuzzies, about supporting much. And Robbie, you should have seen them. They were taking notes frantically. Don't call him. Don't go see him. Oh my goodness. They were traumatized. They were like, never, we're not going to, send him a note. And the interesting thing was that he and one of the other panelists, a younger woman who was probably 50 years his, younger than him, they got in a little bit of a banter about, methods of soliciting. He said, don't ever text me or email me. And she said, don't send me anything through snail mail, because I don't check my mail more than, once every 3 weeks. And he said, that's what's wrong with your generation. And, so they had this little bit themselves, and they both were, African-American alums of Clemson. And so it was a good conversation. People learned a lot. And a few weeks later, one of the senior development officers called me and said, you're not going to believe this, but Mr. So-and-so just made a $500,000 pledge to the university. And you'll never believe who asked him. And I said, tell me. And they said, some of his classmates who are, high level, executives in corporate America, but they, had graduated with him or around the same time as him. But before they asked him to join them in making this pledge, they apologized to him for the experience he had when he attended the university of, racist treatment, and, from students as well as advisors. And then they invited him to join them in making the pledge. And he said he felt that they cared about him and what his interests were. And really his, his disappointment and his, gruffness was based on his hurt. He had just been hurt. And he just needed someone to apologize for the hurt and then care about what his interests were. And so, I just find that interesting that, if you take the time and really understand a donor's motivation and what their interests are, you can not only secure the gift, but maybe secure a gift multiple times bigger than you ever imagined. So I love that story. And I love how surprised everyone was that he actually turned around and made a gift to the university.
When you're telling that story, I'm reminded of that saying that we've all been taught, when you ask for money, you get advice. When you ask for advice, you get money. Mm-hmm. That seems like a classic case of listening to him, getting his advice. And of course, there was no guarantee that you would get a gift that large, but right. At least he would feel heard.
He felt heard. And, I'm not calling him the Grinch, so please, nobody listening, I'm not. But remember when the Grinch's heart that day when he saw them, and they were all singing Bahudore and, dancing around. And they said his heart grew 10 sizes that day. I feel like his heart grew 10 sizes when they said, "We're sorry." Now I'm gonna cry. Let me stop.
So I have two more questions for you before we finish. Imagine for a moment you're at the beginning of your career. What is the best piece of advice you could have given yourself and the worst piece of advice you could have given yourself? Start with the worst.
The
What do you
worst.
wish nobody, what do you wish nobody had told you? Because it wasn't good advice.
Oh, that the road was going to be curvy and filled with rocks and potholes and difficult to navigate because I'm black. I was told that by a college advisor who told me. And I mean, so the crazy thing about that, Robbie, is it was an advisor in a musical theater program that I had made it one of 15 people who were selected for the program over out of over 800 that auditioned for it. So the good and bad of that is, if he hadn't told me that, I wouldn't have left the major, and maybe I would have made it to Broadway, maybe not. But I ended up in fundraising, which ended up being the right career for me. So that bad advice, turned into this great career that I'm in. But the reason why I wish he'd never told me is because that stuck with me for a while, not just because I left the program, but that stuck with me for a while. And having parents who lived through the civil rights movement, who had challenges in their lives as an only child of them. If they had known that's why I left the State University of New York at Fredonia, they would have grabbed me by the collar and marched me back and told me to finish out my degree. But I'm just saying the worst piece of advice, because that stayed with me for a long time.
And how about the best?
The best piece of advice was probably came from the person, and I can't remember exactly who it was, but who told me that I should really consider a career in fundraising. And I really didn't know that it was a thing. But I decided, with being hired by the United Negro College Fund, that maybe that this was something that was new. Although I remember the president and CEO of the Southeastern Council of Foundations in Atlanta, he said that his mother told him that he would have a more respectable job if he, other than fun as a fundraiser, since he had chosen fundraising, excuse me, he'd have a more respectable job if he played piano in a bordello than being a fundraiser.
I'm glad she was wrong.
Right? But that, she told him that in like the, I don't know, 60s or 70s. And so by the time I got into fundraising in the late 80s, 90s, it was turning into a really true career. And in 1995 in Buffalo, New York, I was making $50,000, which was a decent salary in 1995 in Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, it's interesting how stereotypes influence our perceptions of ourselves.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I think I discovered you and I have one more thing in common. My calling in fundraising was discovered by a mentor. I had no idea it was a thing or that I could do it. So, bookends, AFP Global Chairs, and mentors found our muse.
Robbie, I can't believe I said I don't remember who told me that. Shame on me. It was Charles Stevens.
I wondered about that.
Yes, but how am I sitting? I'm just tired. I've been on the road for 3 weeks. But some people directed me, but he was the one that said, "Stay in it and you can make a career out of it."
Good for him. I'm glad he did. I'm glad you listened.
Me too.
So, thank you very much for joining us. I'm sure your lived experience will be inspirational to many people. And I'm grateful that you carved out the time to do this with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. My treat, my pleasure. So this is part of Nonprofit Expert, presented by Donor Perfect, in our series, Relationships, Resources, and Respect.
Thank you for listening to Nonprofit Expert, presented by Donor Perfect. For more information and a special offer, visit donorperfect.com/podcast.